Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from the Mojo magazine and playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the June 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with the reissue of Nick Drake's The Making of his album, Five Leaves Left. And then the 40th anniversary of Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits, and an interview with Peter Murphy of Bauhaus. And the classic album review of Lemonade by Beyoncé. And I begin with the article about Nick Drake, titled Back Where You Began. Nick Drake's storied debut, replant with unheard material over four packed discs, get ready for the making of Five Leaves Left. In mid-June 1969, Nick Drake visited his sister, Gabriella, in her London flat to hand her a just-finished copy of his debut album, Five Leaves Left. Unaware that her brother's quest to make a record was so far advanced, she was startled when he threw it onto her bed with no more fanfare than, well, there you are. For many listeners, Five Leaves Left also hits like a bolt from the blue, a record that seems to have fallen from the sky, or at least the mind of a 20-year-old singer-songwriter, perfectly formed. A different but equally compelling story unfolds with the making of Five Leaves Left, a meticulously compiled four-disc collection of unreleased recordings, harvested from the 13th-month period where Drake, producer Joe Boyd, engineer John Wood, and Drake's fellow Cambridge student and string arranger Robert Kirby intermittently worked on the album. Outtakes from London's Sound Techniques studio and a newly discovered amateur tape culminate in the original LP, its dynamic musical storytelling that not only traces the record's evolution, but gently reframes Drake, who died in 1974 at the age of 26, as a creature of flesh, blood, and strong musical opinions, rather than an ethereal acoustic ghost. In my 30 years of looking after Nick's estate, I've been torn between some of Nick's fans saying, "Why don't you release everything?" And Nick's other fans saying, "How dare you release stuff that Nick didn't sanction," says Collie Kulmanen, who runs Brighter Music and Nick Drake's estate on behalf of Drake's sister. "I've spent years wanting people just to concentrate on the three main albums, not having demos released, because I didn't want to take the focus off Nick's approved orchestrated songs that he was so proud of. But we just felt that after all this time, there is a justifiable reason for putting together what I think is an academic study of how the album came about." The project was initiated in February 2016 when Neil Story, former Island Records head of press and author of the Island Book of Records, was contacted by Universal's A&R director, Johnny Chandler, with a top-secret request. Could Story help interpret some tape boxes from the vaults? Time-consuming, though the task was, it was also the most extraordinary experience, says Story. You're hearing Nick telling in the studio. You're hearing Nick talking in the studio. as a result of Story's painstaking work correcting entrenched inaccuracies, there was a proper old-fashioned roadmap of how those sessions added up to 5 leaves left. They kept going back into the studio to do 3 or 4 more songs to see what came out, then getting new lineups in to do new versions, explains Kalaman of the original sessions. It's always interested me to find out how such an album came about in 1969. Based on what everyone else was doing, it's on its own little island. So Gabrielle, Drake, and I thought, time to try to tell the story. That coincided with 2 completely new tapes coming to light. The first of these was not entirely unknown, a tape of Drake's first session with Boyd and Wood from March 1968. This had spent decades in the care of the singer-songwriter and friend of Drake's, Beverly Martin, at the time married to John Martin. The first thing you hear is Boyd's introductions. "Okay, here we go. Whatever it is, take 1. Whatever it is turned out to be the breezy and, Drake apparently worried, possibly too Kinks-like Mayfair, running straight into Time Has Told Me. Here's a little bit of that song, Time Has Told Me, by Nick Drake.
Time has told me you're rarefied, trouble cure for a troubled mind. Time has told me to ask for more, for someday our ocean will find its shore. So I'll leave the ways that are making me be what I really don't want to be. Leave the ways making me love.
We just sat him down with his guitar and wallop, he did that, recalls Sounds Technique's co-owner Wood, who engineered Drake's LP, produced 1972's Pink Moon, and would sometimes drive Drake back to Cambridge on his way home to Susfolk. Both Joe and I were somewhat stunned by it. Also included are versions of Fruit Tree, Man in a Shed, and Saturday Sun. Drake, handing the notoriously difficult Sound Technique piano with aplomb. Here's some of the song Saturday Sun by Nick Drake.
Saturday sun came early one morning in a sky so clear and blue. But Saturday sun came without warning, no one knew what to do. Saturday sun brought people and faces that didn't seem much in their day. But when I remember those people and places, they were really too good in their way.
The second tape, completely new to us, says Colanon, came from a Cambridge acquaintance of Drake's called Paul de Reves. He took his gray, Grundig reel-to-reel round to Kirby's rooms in Casa College during Lent term, 1968, to record Drake as it prepared for an upcoming live performance on February 23rd. The tape came to Chandler after de Reves met Kenny Jones of the Small Faces and mentioned the recording, which had survived overseas moves to West Africa and Singapore. While the de Reves tape is a repository of intimate versions of Time Has Told Me and Day Is Done, it also offers magical snippets of the elusive Drake in conversation, clearly describing to Kirby what he wants. And here's some of the song Day Is Done by Nick Drake.
When the day is done, down to earth and sinks the sun, along with everything that was lost and won. When the day is done, when the day is done, hope so much your race will be all wrong. Then you find to jump the gun, have to go back where you began. When the day is done, when the night is cold, some get by but some get old, just to show life's not made of gold.
For my love, left with the rain, he desires an expansive a sound as possible. He talks about playing I Was Made to Love Magic at the Roundhouse and discusses how it should sound celestial before running through it twice, using a slightly different rhythm each time. Blossom, he describes as at least a little corny. There's a brooding, unnamed instrumental, too, in which he expresses a desire for a violin. I'm afraid this is proving to be an unprofessional tape, all together partly due to intoxication, he says with a small laugh, before starting the previously unheard whimsy of Mickey's tune. So go your way, and I'll follow on the breeze. Despite the self-deprecation, there's also self-possession, the sound of a man who knows what he wants. That's underlined by the evolution of the album's string arrangements. The first orchestra session was with an arranger called Richard Hewson. He was an utter failure, says Wood, and Nick was not slow in coming forward, saying he didn't like any of it. As an important developmental stage in Five Leaves Left, however, it was decided to include a version of Day Is Done that marries Hewson's string arrangements with Drake's vocals. Drake returned with Kirby, and if Wood and Boyd initially had misgivings about his university friend, they soon evaporated. Robert understood what he wanted with his music, and it was a doodle, says Wood. Kirby was not keen to arrange the 5-4 orchestrations of Riverman, however. Wood called an arranger, Harry Robinson, who arranged ads to the undertow of Unease. He was a great mimic, says Story. If you wanted it to sound like DeLewis or Berklows, he would give you DeLewis. He'd give you Berklows. And here's a little bit of the song, Riverman, by Nick Drake.
Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today. Said she hadn't heard the news, hadn't had the time to choose a way to lose, but she believes. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I can. If he tells me all he knows about the way his river flows and all night shows in summertime.
For Story and Kalamon, judicious editing was vital. That was the point in putting in 10 versions of Strange Face, asked Story. Gabrielle was absolutely, no, we cannot do it like that. It's not every single thing that may well satisfy the purist out there, but it's not doing Nick's legacy any good. Nick made mistakes, says Kalamon. He'd stop a take halfway through and say, this isn't the right tempo, or I fluffed that line. We didn't want any of those in because there didn't seem to be any point. But I was keen to have different arrangements. I wanted people to experience what it would have been like with Danny Thompson coming into the studio and trying out different bass parts on, for example, Cello Song. And the way that John worked was everybody in a room playing together, apart from Richard Thompson's overdubs. The making of Five Leaves Left allows listeners to be in the room too, to share in the clear joy that the participants took in the process. I really used to enjoy recording Nick, says Wood. He was just pretty much a friend. When you're making records, the buzz, the thrill, is when a group of people sit down in front of you and create something great, something extraordinary. It doesn't always happen that way, but it did with Nick. And now the article about the reissue of Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms, titled Industrial Complex. One of the first albums to be digitally recorded, mixed and mastered, is back for its 40th anniversary. Their Soul Beneath the Sheen discovers Keith Cameron. Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms. Of all the artists to herald the digital age with its shiny new compact disc format, Dire Straits were surely the least likely. Workhorses rather than high-gloss show ponies, they emerged from London's mid-70s pub rock circuit, featuring two former members of Brewer's Droop, playing country-tinged blues boogie, written by self-effacing ex-newspaper reporter and schoolteacher from Newcastle, Mark Knopfler, had tried many other jobs before rock and roll, and beyond inoculating respects for Harge Graft and emphasizing where his gifts truly lay, none prepared him for leading the world's biggest band, which is pretty much what Dire Straits became on the back of their fifth album, Brothers in Arms, was UK number one for 14 weeks and spent 9 weeks on top of the US chart, scooping up worldwide sales of over 20 million, driven by a year-long 1985-86 world tour, numbering 248 shows and a string of hit singles, none bigger than Money for Nothing, a Billboard number one turbocharged by its state-of-the-art computer-animated video, to all intents and purposes, an advertisement for MTV, which duly repaid the debt in endless rotation. And here's a little bit of that song, Money for Nothing, by Dire Straits, from the album Brothers in Arms. To these numbers and legacy, Brothers in Arms ceased to be a mere album and became a pop cultural avatar. Imagine a silver 1937 National Resonator guitar slapping you in the face forever. It's ironic that a record which became synonymous with more began as an attempt at less. Knopfler was craving a return to roots after first 1980s Jimmy Iovine produced Making Movies had powerfully upgraded the 1978 debut Dire Straits, Backroom Chugle, and then 1982's still startling Love Over Gold, an epic suite of abstract expansions plotting the geometry of thin air, in ways that would be subsequently pursued by Talk Talk and Radiohead. Yet, in the interim, he had also made some movie soundtracks, most notably Local Hero, where his theme was as much the star of the film as either Burt Lancaster or the Scottish Highlands, and bought a Synclaver digital synthesizer and hired Roxy Music's Guy Fletcher to play it. Ergo, essentially Brothers in Arms, songs like So Far Away and Why Worry are intense miniature dialogues transposed to widescreen and fill grid with the latest tech. The former feels like a Dust Bowl Mudrick refuge from Avalon, while the later's lonesome melodies and hanging chords were soon acknowledged worthy of an Everly Brothers cover version. And here's a little bit of that song, Why Worry, from Dire Straits. Album's most minimal song, tellingly Why Worry, was also its longest. The Cajun trifle Walk of Life became a radio perennial, but it was never more than a throwaway ditty, and intended, and indeed co-producer Neil Dorsman wanted to do just that. The Knopf said no. He felt its charm and got his way. Knopfler's gift was always to see the significance in minor inflections, but they emotional or musical. And here's some of that song, Walk of Life, by Dire Straits. The Man's Too Strong, meanwhile, is as low-key as a Celtic-tinged character study of a suspected Nazi war criminal possibly could be. And here's some of that song, The Man's Too Strong, from Dire Straits, from their album Brothers in Arms.
I'm just an aging drummer boy, and in the wars I used to play, and I've called a tune to many a torture session. Now they say I am a war criminal, and I'm fading away. Father, please hear my confession. I have legalized robbery, called it belief. I have a run with the money, I have a hit like a thief. Rewritten history with my armies and my crooks, invented memories. I did burn all the books, and I can still hear his laughter, and I can still hear his song. The man's too big, the man's too strong.
These embroidered cameos land the epic set piece Your Latest Trick whiffs of mid-70s Dylan jamming with Steely Dan, complete with the Brecker Brothers giving it the full lounge act. Knopfler had worked with them on Gaucho's Time Out of Mind, a reportedly stressful experience for him, but this time they were playing to his tune. Right across the river is Springsteen gone white reggae for a woolly dog of war tableau. Better by far is the title track's haunted battlefield evocation. Barely there, but speaking louder for it, spiraling upwards like Pink Floyd with warm blood in the veins. In Paul Sexton's sleeve notes for the deluxe edition, Knopfler reveals the title came from a comment his father had made about the Falklands War and the irony of the Soviet Union backing a fascist junta in Argentina. And here's some of the song Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits.
But my home is the lowlands.
someday you'll return to your valleys and your farms, and you'll no longer burn to be brothers in arms.
Of course, much of Brothers in Arms, lowercase intrigue, is eclipsed by Money for Nothing. And how could it not? The greatest riff Billy Gibbons never wrote. The guest vocal from Sting, literally dragged in off the beach and asked to sing I Want My MTV in the tune of one of his own songs, and a notoriously jarring lyric. Knopfler was not the first to discover that pop songs aren't the safest vehicles for hiding an obnoxious narrator. But as a deep fan of Randy Newman, he perhaps ought not to have been too surprised when people were offended by his voicing a pair of hardware store workers watching a little faggot playing guitar on the televisions they were shifting. Come the Brothers in Arms tour, he was already self-censoring, and whatever subversive commentary the song had to offer on the process of fame. A rock star who resented making videos singing a song satirizing people who resent rock stars, watching rock stars on video, was rendered moot. This 40th anniversary version is unlikely to shift the critical dial on a record about which most people have long since made a decision. There are no studio outtakes suggesting alternate paths, which is a shame, as the sleeve notes trace the pre-production process from Knopfler's West London muse to Ray Manzanera's studio in Surrey, and thence to George Martin's fabled AIR outpost in the Caribbean. Almost all drummer Terry Williams' contributions in Montserrat were replaced by jazz session ace Omar Hakim. And if they still exist somewhere, they're not here. At least Terry was back on the stool for the 1985-86 tour, which provides the only real inducement for diehard fans to buy. The deluxe edition has the entire unreleased San Antonio concert from August 16, 1985, a faithful representation of how far a groovy little rock and roll band had gone in less than 10 years. The two remaining originals, Knopfler and John Isley, surrounded by extra keyboardist, saxophone, and percussion, their songs appended with yawning intros and multiple crescendos that threaten to secede from the thing they're obstinately bringing to a close. Not a single note out of place. Amidst it all, Knopfler's virtuosity remains somewhat both transcendent and earthy, his perennial saving grace. By the end of that 12-month tour, Mark Knopfler was as tired of Dire Straits as anyone. Five more years elapsed before the follow-up to Brothers in Arms, 1991's Scruffler, even longer, On Every Street, after which he called time on the whole dog and pony show, fed up with being famous for merely playing his guitar on that damn MTV. Success I adore, he told Sylvie Simmons in a 1996 interview, "As far as I can see, fame is just a waste product of success." And I think we have enough time for another article. And this is an obituary. Real gone. Neat, neat, neat. Punk prime mover and damned guitarist Brian James left us on March the 6th. If the Damned were the band of first in UK punk rock, releasing both a single and an album before the Sex Pistols and the Clash, it was all down to their visionary leader, Brian James, who shaped the aesthetic of punk's first wave. The sound in James's head was action rock and roll, a distinctly British evolution of the feral music he had obsessed over in his teens. Turn of the 70s Detroit failures, the Stooges, and MC5, together with Beat Pop Flops, the Pretty Things, whose mid-60s repertoire he once assured me shits all over the Stones. Just like his heroes, however, James never got his dues. Two, the last, a gentle soul who didn't shout as loud as all the other self-appointed punk originators. Born Brian Robertson on February 18, 1955, in Hammersmith, aged 18, he already had a band up and running, gigging alongside Hawkwind and the Pink Fairies at free festivals. Even so, he admitted, it was hard for the straight clubs to promote us with a name like Bastard. So the combo relocated to Belgium. When James nipped home for Christmas 1975, however, he answered a musician's wanted ad, which mentioned the Stooges, and hooked up with Mick Jones, later of the Clash, and Tony James, Generation X, in the legendary proto-punk band, the London SS, who duly rehearsed the majority of what became the first Damned LP. After a few months, though, the guitarist broke away and formed the Damned, who soon took flight under his relatively experienced leadership. Thus, they beat their rivals to the punch with October 76's pulsating New Rose single, and 4 months later, the immortal Damned, Damned, Damned. And here's a little bit of the song New Rose by the Damned. Soon ostracized from punk's inner circle when James challenged Malcolm McLaren's controversy-fixated stewardship of December 76's abortive anarchy tour with the Pistols. After intensive touring in 1977, the Damned's combustible energy flamed out, and James split the band. We'd been hammering it, drinking, doing drugs, having fun, he shrugged in 2022. No regrets, that's for sure, never. In the aftermath, the other three reformed without him. But James landed a dream gig in Iggy Pop's band and soon gathered the Lords of the New Church with Dead Boys singer Stiv Bators, scoring cult-level indie hits. After a late 80s reunion of the original Damned, concluded in fisticuffs, James operated solo at the margins, touring a blaze through of Damned, Damned, Damned in the early 2000s with Scabies and front woman Texie Terry. With so much bad blood, it was a surprise when, mid-pandemic, the original four announced a reunion. In advance of the much-postponed dates in October 22nd, James told this writer he had been in and out of hospital. "And I caught COVID in there." He performed propped up on an amp, clearly not well, but his slashing, adrenalized guitar style remained robust. Gloric, iconic, a last gasp triumph for Brit Punk's under-the-radar architect. Now it's time for this week's classic album review, and this week it's Lemonade by Beyoncé, 2016. I'm not a black woman, despite being raised by one, and in tandem with one my own age. I have no special insight into the experience and specific sentiments of black women. So, for the purpose of this review, I talked to my twin sister. I talked to her about this project because, in truth, it's intimidating. From the word go, Lemonade's fiercely political imagery made it untouchable. It quickly became an anthem of black womanhood in the same way that To Pimp a Butterfly became a symbol of woke blackness last year. To critique the causes it stands for, the lives it seemingly lends value. This is the trouble with political albums in our modern political climate. They invite discussion, but silence criticism. To critically engage with them is to sit quietly and listen. So that's what I did. I listened to this album, and I listened to my sister. I'll do my best to weave her sentiments into this review alongside my own feelings regarding the actual music here. It's going to be a bit long and more than a bit rough, but it's necessary. The black woman is a vessel, unlike almost any other demographic or entity in this nation, the U.S., the black woman has been vilified, victimized, violated, and viscerated. Her physical features are denounced as ugly, only to be appropriated in trademarked lip gloss and padded panties. Her emotions are ignored unless they are violent, at which point they are lampooned as bestial and uncouth. For the black woman, the only socially accepted position is subservience. She can adorn after cooking supplies and clean your house, but in music, she is free. Since the advent of the African diaspora, music has been a method of resistance, a method of unleashing the stifled anger and righteous indignation inherent to the black female subject position. And in that, Beyoncé's latest follows a long line of wonderfully dissonant and transgressive acts that looked to give voice to the black female experience. But where Nina lamented the struggle and Billy bemoaned the losses, Beyoncé turns her critique inwards, focusing more on the black community as an increasingly fractious body. Lemonade stands not just as an examination of a black woman's position in society at large, but also the ways in which black women are asked to acquiesce within their own communities. Commitment is key here, as we've seen with two major title releases this year. Lack of theme and coherence can undo even the most well-produced albums. The life of Pablo loses power as it abandons its religious themes for two-thirds of the album, only to half-acidly return to them on the next to last real track. Wolves, Frank's track, is really the last track on TLOP. The rest are bonuses. On Anti, Rihanna's themes of self-empowerment and cultural integrity fall flat as she desperately tries to either mimic the bombast of Beyoncé or the narcanized apathy of Abel Tesfaye. But Beyoncé's triumph comes from her avoiding these pitfalls and her excellent curation. The themes of the album, fidelity, community, and liberation, ooze forth from every track on this album. On many of the tracks, the themes are almost comically self-evident. On Freedom, Bey belts, "Freedom, freedom, cut me loose." And here's a little bit of that song, Freedom, from Beyoncé. All Night, she sings that my love was stronger than your pride. And here's a little bit of that song, All Night, by Beyoncé.
We found the truth beneath your lies. And true love has to hide.
True love never has to hide.
I trade your broken wings for mine.
Trade your broken wings for mine.
I've seen your scars and kissed your crime.
Seen your scars and kissed your crime.
So many people that I know, they just trying to.
The cathartic gospel of Pray You Catch Me will have you speaking in tongues so long as your voice isn't choked out by the tears that come with putting the pieces together and discovering the heinous infidelity of a partner. And here's a little bit of that song, Pray You Catch Me, by Beyoncé.
So cavalier, but even that's a test. Constantly aware of it all, my lonely ear pressed against the walls of your world, praying to catch you whispering.
For Beyoncé, black women and black men have a single shared desire, a shared goal that nothing should detract us from. We should be a united front, a mixed army fighting in the pursuit of progress. Unfortunately, things have gotten out of hand, and our focus has been lost. But there's hope, and with Lemonade, Beyoncé's telling us all to regain formation. And unfortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the most current July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an article about Tim Buckley, Jeff Buckley's dad, who died 50 years ago of a tragic overdose. and also a short interview with Moody Blues singer Justin Haywood, and a classic album review of Into the Great Wide Open by Tom Petty. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
I'm praying I catch you whispering. I'm praying you catch me listening.